Support for Iditapod, a production of Alaska Public Media, comes from MVFCU. Experience the MVFCU way.
Beep, boop, beep, boop, boop. Dialing up Zach Hughes.
Bring, bring.
Ding, diddling, ding, 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 ding. Theme music.
Ding, diddling, ding, 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 ding.
Sorry, your microphone's off. I can't hear you. Welcome to the Iditapod. That's right, it's a podcast about the Iditarod. I'm your host, Casey Grove. Before we jump on in, here's a word from our sponsor.
Support for Iditapod comes from Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, taking pride in its strong ties to Alaska's communities.
We are just a few days away from the start of this year's Iditarod. Once the race kicks off, this podcast is going to switch over to daily episodes each morning. For now, we're doing, I guess you could call, some prequels for this year's race coverage. Before the race starts, though, we're going to talk about what this season has been like for some of the mid-distance sled dog races in Alaska. And to do that, I'm joined by Alaska Public Media's Zachariah Hughes. Welcome, Zach.
Hello, Casey Grove.
Zach, there's all kinds of different dog mushing races. What are the sort of the mid-distance qualifiers? What are some of the big ones that we look for heading into Yukon Quest and Iditarod?
Mostly, I look at mid-distance races. Those are races of between generally 150, 200 miles, all the way up to 440 miles is the longest. And those are what are called qualifiers for the Iditarod. The rules stipulate that in order to be eligible to run in the Iditarod, you need to have about, I think it's 750 miles in competitive and sanctioned races. When we talk about a lot of the race season, what I'm looking at are races like the Copper Basin 300, the Kobuk 440, the Kuskokwim 300, some things like that. There's also the Yukon Quest, but that's in sort of a class all of its own, closer to the Iditarod, since it's a 1,000-mile race with its own qualifications. And I mean, you'd know better than I have since you've covered.
I would just add there's shorter versions of the Yukon Quest that can serve as qualifiers for either race later on down the road. And of course, those qualifiers only matter the first time you're trying to finish the Iditarod, because if you finished it, then you're sort of automatically qualified at that point, right?
Yes. There's also lots of shorter races. Some of those are much more local, like there's sprint races all over the place, and probably the most high profile are the Ferrande races in February, just ahead of Iditarod. So there's lots of different sled dog races. We tend to just focus on some of the most high profile.
There's a lot of different races, and a lot of people maybe don't even hear the names of these races, and some of them are even kind of having some trouble and having to be canceled because of poor weather and trail conditions. Tell me about that.
I think back to a quote that Martin Boozer gave.
If the new normal is glare ice, bare ground, traveling 150 miles to run 50 miles by dog team and then drive home 150 miles by truck, if that's the new normal, is it really worth spending 365, every penny, every hour, every bit of energy on just driving dogs?
The point that he was making is that climate change and more variable weather for a lot of parts of Alaska have really put the future of consistent training opportunities for the sport into jeopardy. And, you know, as long as I've been covering sled dog races in Alaska, there's been inconsistency. There's been races that have been canceled, races that have not been renewed. Some of those are organizational things, but the Willow 300, which is a relatively new race and quite popular, this year in January had to cancel because there was rain. And, you know, Willow's sort of informal slogan is the sled dog capital of the world. If it's raining in January in Willow, there's just more stuff like that.
We call the Iditarod the Super Bowl of dog mushing, and what we want to talk about is sort of a recap of all the races that lead up to it, and it actually kind of starts right after the Iditarod ends. So if we go back to last year, your Leif Seth Olsom wins, Nick Petit in second, Mitch Seavey in third. What happens after the Iditarod last year as far as like the next race season starting?
So the Iditarod winds down, and there's actually this other sled dog race that's a qualifier, the Kobuk 440 out of Kotzebue, that follows less than a month later. That's 440 miles through the Northwest Arctic Borough from Kotzebue all the way out to Ambler and then Kobuk and then back to Kotzebue. Really cool race, and Nick Petit won that. Tony Browning got second. Ellen King was in third. You know, it's not the most high-profile roster a lot of the time because it's really expensive to get your dogs to another bush race. Kotzebue, not on the road system, so it's got a different flavor. it's a lot of the same people who are mushing in the Iditarod, or it's people that are maybe their handlers or people that are doing their qualifiers. Really cool race. I was up there not reporting, but just hanging out in Kotzebue.
Having some fun.
Having a little bit of fun. And it, you know, it is fun because it's a lot of the same people. Ellen King, who is Jeff King's daughter, was running his team. She got third. And so up there, you know, Jeff King is there. Some of his handlers are up there. Some of his friends. It's a lot of the same people who are around races in the earlier part of the year. But with the Iditarod over, I have to say a lot of the stress is really off. And it's a beautiful time of year in the Arctic.
So that's kind of at the end of last year's race season. It's a qualifier for races coming up after that, of course. And then we have this year's race season starting this winter. Tell me about that. Where are we at with the mid-distance mushing for this season?
The Copper Basin 300 is kind of when I start tuning in. That's in you know, early to mid-January. And this year, Nick Petit won that race for the second year in a row.
Congratulations. Thank you. Welcome back.
So that's, you know, Nick Petit pulling into Glen Allen. He had a pretty solid win in that race. The Tustamina 200 is another race this past winter. Nick Petit got third in that. Dave Turner took first, and Sim Smith was in second. That was the only race that I could find that Mitch Seavey raced in. He took fifth place. So there's those. Right after the Copper Basin 300, just a week later, is the Kuskokwim 300, which is a big deal. Like, the K300 has a reputation as one of the most tough, grueling, competitive races, in part because it has such an enormous race purse. And Nick Petit was back there, also placed really high. There was a little bit of confusion. He didn't win. First place was kind of solidly won by Matthew Fahler. He had not won before. This was only his third K300, and he's been mushing for a while, but this was definitely his most high-profile win. He pulled in kind of early in the morning on the last day of the race, but he was followed so closely by a kind of dense pack of other mushers that, you know, we were kind of unsure whose headlight we were looking at coming in second place after Fahler.
Same group from last year, and they're a fantastic, wonderful, intelligent group of dogs.
Okay, tell us, you've got somebody on your tail here. Who was that? Do you even know?
I have no idea.
Okay, well, we heard that Nicholas Petit did not have a tracker from Tulsac, so nobody knew exactly where he was. Whoever it is just G'd his dogs over into the finishing chute, so we'll have to see who it is.
I had no idea.
Here he comes. Your second place loping in here.
And it was Nick Petit.
Surprise.
Surprise. That was Angela Denning reporting for KYUK in the race finish as it happened. That was who was asking Matt Fahler those questions. Nick Petit comes in, and everybody's kind of surprised because on the tracker that people had maybe been watching, he had not been in second place. And so it was a little bit of a surprise when he did pull in. And what happened was Nick was confused. He asked some questions, and it came out that he did not have his tracker, his GPS tracker. It had been left behind somewhere further along the trail. He knew that, but he said he had lost the trail and came in from another direction. And, you know, immediately on, he didn't try to hide that or obfuscate that at all. He was pretty candid that he must have taken a wrong turn.
I just came from that side. You did? Yeah, I took the wrong turn.
And it came out in the next, you know, few minutes, and then over a couple of hours as it was looked into, that Petit had cut down Church Slough, which is off of the established trail, and it shaves a little bit of time off of the trail. He was off the trail and he just kind of kept going. Race rules stipulate that if you do lose the trail, you've got to backtrack and pick it back up to find where you're going. So, you know, it really echoed Petit going off course during the Iditarod. Before, he was pretty self-deprecating and a little bit angry with himself when that came out.
Yeah, getting lost, that's what I do, I get lost.
So Petit pulled in second, but then an hour was added to his time. And so ultimately the leaderboard looked like Matt Fahler in first, Pete Kaiser in second, Jesse Holmes came in third. He'd actually also lost the trail and then did what the rules stipulate. He backtracked to find it once he realized he was off and came in third. Nick Petit took fourth. Jeff King was in fifth. And then Yor Olsom came in sixth after that.
Petit finishing near the top of some of these big races or winning them and putting a lot of miles on since the end of the Iditarod last year, the Kobuk 440, the Copper Basin 300, the Kuskokwim 300. There's this other little race we call the Yukon Quest. It's another 1,000-mile race. There are fewer checkpoints, so there's longer distance in between. And the winner was a pretty hometown guy, Brent Sass, winning it for his second time, with the first time in 2015.
Can I just ask, why do you call Brent Sass a hometown guy? I mean, you're a Fairbanks guy. You're from Fairbanks, born and raised, for better or worse. Why do you call Brent Sass a hometown guy?
I call Brent Sass a hometown guy because he went to the University of Alaska Fairbanks. He moved up from Minnesota and lived out in Goldstream, kind of in my neighborhood when I was going to school up there. I even took my dog to a party at his place, and his dogs and my dogs partied somewhere else, and then I found him later. But
he's your dog.
Yeah, he's my dog. But we, you know, you would see him around Fairbanks in those days as he was really getting into dog mushing and, you know, really got bitten by that bug. Ultimately, he ended up moving out to a place called Joe Bush Creek, which is near Eureka, which is north of Fairbanks near Manly Hot Springs. And he's out there full time. He's got a kennel, wild and free mushing. Really interesting guy and always a top contender in the races that he enters. Like I said, won the Yukon Quest in 2015. He's finished the Iditarod three times. He got disqualified in 2015 for having an iPod Touch, which in Tanana, strange that they would have disqualified him in Tanana of all places.
I think the issue was that it had been technically connected to network or something like that. So it could have had the potential to have communicated and had outside messages. There's no evidence that Brent had used it for that, but right. It seemed to many like that was an overly punitive take on things.
So he wins the Yukon Quest in 2015. He gets disqualified for violating a rule maybe that isn't even a rule anymore. They've since changed that. He had a really rough time late in the race, the last time he ran the Iditarod, and that sort of caused him to take some time off from racing even. So I know it was a big deal for him to return to the Yukon Quest, return to racing, and to win this 1,000-mile race with a very hometown welcome when he crossed the finish line in Fairbanks.
Nobody has ever chanted my name when I got to Fairbanks. But yeah, so he pulled in, he won that, and, you know, Brent makes no effort to hide his emotions, which in a sport known for sort of tough machismo is kind of refreshing, actually. I mean, he weeps openly in interviews.
Definitely wears it on his sleeve.
It was awesome. That's how I could explain this this race and this whole experience I just had with these dogs. It's amazing. I'm going to cry a lot here, so just fair warning.
So I had a chance to talk to him by phone from Eureka, from his place out there. The audio is not perfect. It's like a Wi-Fi phone call, but we talked for a while. We're going to have a much longer bonus episode of the podcast with that full interview in it. But for now, we talked about his Yukon Quest this year, getting back into racing, when he's maybe thinking about going back into the Iditarod, and a little bit about some of the controversies that might have discouraged him and other mushers from actually entering the Iditarod. So here's the shorter version of the interview with Brent Sass. Thanks for being here, Brent.
Yeah, no problem. Thanks for having me.
Tell me kind of how overall your race went.
This year's race was a little different than a lot of the races that I've had, you know, in the past 5 years. I had a real competitive team starting back in 2014, and ever since then, I had, you know, my goal was to win the race. And so this was a little bit different because I took a year off last year, and then I came into this race with a bunch of young dogs, a lot of dogs that had never raced before. 11 of them had never been in the Yukon Quest before. I only had 3 veterans. So I went into this race with really no expectation to have fun, have a clean race, take care of my dogs, and just focus purely on my team. And, you know, that's obviously everyone's ultimate goal. But as you get competitive, things become more and more, difficult to do that. And that was my main goal. And I didn't pay attention to my competition at all. And so we were just out running dogs, literally. And it was a miracle team. And my whole crew there kind of sat down before the race and made a real clear plan, based the second half completely on how that dog team looked when we got to Dawson. And everything came together. Is the short version of it. I stuck to that plan all the way to the finish line, and it brought us there in first place. You know, I mean, I had 14 at the finish line, and they all could go run another 1,000 miles right now. It was definitely a magic carpet ride.
The last time you were in the Iditarod had kind of a rough go at the end. And you said your dogs could have run another 1,000 miles. And I guess, you know, I kind of remember back to 2015 and, you know, you just won the Yukon Quest and the Iditarod disqualified you over having an iPod, which is like a rule that they've changed now to make that allowed. And, you know, I got to ask, are you thinking about coming back to the Iditarod at some point?
Yeah, and there's a really good chance it'll happen next year. You know, all that stuff, it's all part of my past. It had its positives and negatives. You know, I definitely love the Iditarod Trail. The trail itself is an amazing trail to travel on. The conditions are awesome. The competition is obviously the best in the world. And so it's going to be hard to keep me away from there. I mean, I think they're starting to get things straightened out there at Iditarod as well. I mean, I got a good dog team, and these guys are all young, and they're ready to rock and roll. I need to seize the opportunity and race these dogs. I'm fired up and ready to go. I wish I was in Iditarod this year. But that's not the right thing for my dog team. So, it's about being patient, doing what's right for my dog team. And I feel like right now I'm setting a goal to run the Quest in Iditarod next year.
Do you think some of the issues with the Iditarod, it's kind of like a few different things. There was this, people are calling it dog doping with like Dallas Seavey's team and some of the stuff with the board and I guess conflicts of interest. Do you think those kind of things, have they discouraged mushers from racing in the Iditarod?
Yeah, I think it definitely discourages people. I mean, it's never a good thing when your peers are accused of doping their dogs and deny it and it turns into a big debacle. That's never a good thing. But I think, like anything, we're all going to get through it. I think that they're making the positive changes that need to be made. I think that there's still lots of work to do, but I think we're going to get through it. As a sport and as a profession, I think that all of us just want what's best for the dogs, and I think that's we're on the way to doing that. And Iditarod, I think we all just as individuals have to support our sport and stand behind each other and be as positive as we can about the whole thing, because there's a lot of naysayers out there that we have to make sure that we don't give a window in.
Okay, well, last question. I don't want to put you on the spot too much, but who do you think is going to win the Iditarod this year?
Oh, man. You know, I don't know. I think that it's going to be a fun race to watch. I think the person who runs their own race is going to win the race. And there's a lot of guys out there that are capable of doing that. You know, Nick Pettit, Jesse Holmes, yours obviously in the mix. I mean, there's so many. I can't even start mentioning the names that could be in the top spot, you know. Yeah, we'll see what happens. But I have my money on one of those young guns. Any of those guys are going to be fighting for that spot. But I think the guy who runs his own dog team is going to end up prevailing. To be clear, that's who I would have my money on. But I don't have enough money to be putting money on dog races.
Yeah, me neither. Well, Brent, thanks for being here. I appreciate talking to you, man.
Yep, no problem.
So that's 2019 Yukon Quest champion Brent Sass out of Wild and Free Mushing. After this one last race, he's going to be headed up to the Arctic to do some expeditions, which is all sort of part of making money and training your dogs. Training your dogs being a huge thing in racing to get them up to race shape. You had a little experience with some mushers training. How did that go?
Good. Yeah. I'll tell you the full story later. So there's this lodge on the Denali Highway in Alaska. The Denali Highway is, you know, 135-mile road through the Denali Borough, Matanuska-Susitna Borough, kind of interior Alaska. But the road is not maintained in the winter, and other than some grooming along it, but it's closed to kind of truck traffic and car traffic. So it becomes this kind of 100-mile-plus training ground for a lot of mushers who have for years used it as a way to get miles on their dogs with some kind of safe, consistent training conditions. I'd heard about a lodge in the middle and actually from hunting trips and driving the road myself. I'd seen it. I knew about it. But I'd heard more and more mushers were starting to go there. And I had some acquaintances who were training out of there. So Quince Mountain and Blair Braverman are a couple. They run a kennel together out of Wisconsin. And they've, in the last year or so, as they've done their qualifiers, getting ready for Blair Braverman to run the Iditarod this year, we've met. We've talked and hung out. And they're very active on social media. So we sort of correspond that way. And when they were out at Alpine, I said, you know, can I go out there? And we kind of made a plan. And I got to go. So we're going to play a story about the lodge and how extreme it is just getting out there and why mushers have chosen that as a destination in the last few years. The Alpine Creek Lodge sits 67 unplowed miles east from the small town of Cantwell, which means that in the winter, getting there involves either sled dogs or snow machine.
Trail's really flat and packed down. Doesn't look like there's been much of any vehicle traffic over it other than snow machines and dog sleds.
Besides some caribou and a half dozen moose along the way, the trail is clear and fast. Claude Bondy bought the lodge a decade ago when the building was just a shell.
We're open every day year-round.
Bondy sits midway between a big-bellied wood stove and the long tables where guests eat communal meals, a subtle way to get strangers talking with one another like they might have at an old roadhouse. On the wall behind him, there's an array of shimmering pelts. Beaver, marten, fox, all trapped and fleshed by his 15-year-old son, Bob. Bondy says back when the family was getting the lodge going, there was almost no traffic down the Denali Highway from the Cantwell side over the winter. A few mushers would use the road for training their dog teams, but they packed in supplies and roughed it.
To me, that sounded like an opportunity.
Today, the family's business caters mostly to hunters, snow machiners. There's even a lavish trapping package that costs almost $1,000 a day. As guests, Bondy says the mushers are relatively self-reliant, hardy, and low maintenance. And to other guests, they give the lodge a touch of rugged flavor.
In one particular year, we had 50 of 80 mushers in the Iditarod had trained out of here that winter.
There are other lodges along the Denali Highway, but they close up for parts of the year. Alpine Creek gets a steady flow of mushers through even the darkest, coldest months. Nathan Krasinski is a handler for Jeff King's kennel, breaking up a long training run with an overnight stay at Alpine Creek.
This is lap of luxury.
The hot meals, soft bed, hospitality, Krasinski says, make hours on the sled a little bit more bearable. But he's quick to add that the reason for coming this far is less about creature comforts than how the snowy stretches of highway fit into conditioning a competitive dog team.
Here, it's kind of more the trail is groomed, the trail is wider, the dogs can just get in the zone and work on their endurance.
One of the distinguishing features of the Iditarod Trail is how varied the terrain is. There are highly technical sections that can test a musher's ability to just hold on to the sled. Then there are long, flat sections that can test a musher's ability to just stay awake. The 135-mile highway helps with practicing the latter.
We are living on what may be the greatest dog sled training trail in the world. And we don't have to groom it ourselves.
Blair Braverman is an Iditarod rookie whose kennel is in Wisconsin. She's been living at Alpine Creek for most of the winter, renting a tiny cabin just a stone's throw from the lodge's one permanent dog yard. Braverman says getting to meet and talk with so many of the sport's veterans is another major benefit.
I mean, this place is the Chelsea Hotel for long-distance dog sledders.
It's a reference to a New York City hotel known for hosting literary luminaries, famous artists, and rock stars over the years. The other perk to posting up at the lodge is that a big share of basic chores are essentially outsourced.
It reminds me a little bit of an artist residency where, like, they feed you and the food's delicious and you have a beautiful place to stay and those things are taken care of so that you can train obsessively hard on the thing you're there to do. You know, I'm mushing harder than I have in my life. And one of the reasons I can do that is because I know I can come in and I don't also have to cook.
Braverman and her partner, Quince Mountain, are trading off turns doing a 300-mile training series with their dogs. After getting them into harnesses, booties, and clipped onto the gang line, the dogs are amped up. But when Mountain pulls the snow hook, the shrill, husky yapping disappears, replaced by the soft squeak of snow under sled runners and a flutter of paws down a hard-packed ribbon of trail. Besides the occasional moose lumbering into the willows, Mountain says this is all there is for the dogs to concentrate on.
The longer I've been mushing, the more I want to kind of decrease the variables involved in training so that the training is really just about the dogs getting conditioned to run and getting mentally tough.
The run lasts 44 miles, followed by a few hours of rest right beside the road, then 44 miles back to the lodge, repeated over and over as the young team gets ready to try running all the way to Nome.
So kind of this little oasis of mushing there that they know they're going to have good snow conditions and good trails to run on.
I would say so, yeah. I mean, it's a comfy place, but it's kind of ideal training conditions for the dogs. And instead of having to deal with all the logistics of packing stuff in and roughing it out there, there's a place where you can sleep in a warm bed and have somebody else feed you, and you can just really focus on training.
So Blair, training for this year's Iditarod, she's an up-and-coming young musher rookie in the Iditarod. And Quince is also going to be following along and talking to us, I hear?
Yes. Quince Mountain is going to be contributing to the podcast. It's a little unclear how, because Quince's plan is to follow the race by snow machine.
Burly.
Yeah, pretty hardy. And so we're going to be checking in with him about trail conditions, about some of the race from that vantage point. So we're looking forward to having another voice, another contributor with a more hands-on take on a lot of the particulars of mushing.
Another person who knows way more about dog mushing than you or I do, and potentially someone that can help us answer questions from the listeners. We are again soliciting questions. You can email those if you want to just type it out to iditarod@alaskapublic.org. But because we work in radio and podcasts, we love audio. So if you want to record your question about the Iditarod or about dog mushing, open up your smartphone app. There's usually a voice recording memo in there. Record yourself asking the question and then email that to iditarod@alaskapublic.org. We would really appreciate it. We'll try to get your question answered for today. That is all the time that we have. Joined again by Zachariah Hughes. Thank you for being here, getting ready to go out on the trail. Must be getting exciting.
Exciting, stress dreams, the full range of emotion.
The roller coaster that is the Iditarod. We'll be back with one more episode before we kick off the race and start our daily coverage. Until then, our theme music is by the band Sassafras. I'm your host, Casey Grove, and until next time, happy trails. But like we can BS a little bit for the podcast, and then we can, I'll just ask you some questions to sort of more formally or whatever. So,
okay, I'm out here in Eureka, Joe Bush Creek, just hanging out. My handler Steve is out here hanging out right now. We're just running the dogs. And
cool. Is that Steve Stoller by any chance?
It is Steve Stoller. You know him very well.
I just talked to Kristen Knight Pace. His name came up and what was it, the end of the 2016 quest came up?
Yep.
Yeah. So anyway, can't get into that stuff on the radio, unfortunately.
Yeah, that was an exciting time. We all remember it well. I'm talking to Casey right now.
Oh, is he right there?
He says hi. Yeah, he's right here.
Yeah, tell him I said hi. Someday we'll talk about that publicly.
Yeah. Well.